Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company. Let's see, get the names right here. And you are?
Emily McCarty, Your Honor.
Very well, good morning. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Imagine your first day back to work after an extended break. You're nervous and excited, and maybe when you wake up, you drank too much coffee. And you arrive at work to meet with your boss and realize that you have to use the restroom. Bad. You ask where the bathrooms are, and they tell you it's not part of their job to make sure that you have a bathroom. You ask everyone you can think of. You go to security. They can't help. You find the company nurse, and you find out that there's a policy that says in order to have access to a bathroom, you have to wait for 3 days while you get clearance. The nurse tells you there's an outhouse out back, however, and the door is broken, so anyone of the opposite sex can walk in. Plus, someone's in there right now getting sick, so it probably won't be clean or sanitary, but you can check back in 15 minutes if you want to try using it. Meanwhile, there's nowhere at all you can go to the bathroom. With every moment that passes, you are praying that you don't lose control of your bladder and stain your trousers and humiliate yourself in front of everyone. For those of you who have never lactated or been in an unanticipated situation in which someone is preventing you from nursing or pumping for hours, it's almost impossible to imagine what it was like for Angela Ames on the day she returned from maternity leave. The best analogy I can think of is for you to imagine a time when you had to use the restroom worse than you've ever had to use it before. You are beyond discomfort, and you are feeling the physical pain to the extent that it takes over your entire thought process. The reason it's so important to understand what the physical condition of engorged breasts feels like is because without that knowledge, no one can possibly evaluate whether Angela Ames behaved reasonably in feeling she had no choice but to leave her job. The district court held that no reasonable person in Angela's shoes could find it intolerable for her employer to subject her to increasingly severe physical pain. The district court held that no one in her shoes could possibly find it intolerable for an employer to endanger her ongoing physical ability to nurse her child. This was error, and these questions of fact must be reserved for the jury.
Now, one concern I had with this argument, I appreciate the analogy, but I thought your client testified that physically she could tolerate a couple more hours without nursing, which strikes me as inconsistent with the bladder bursting scenario where the person needs to use the restroom immediately. You wouldn't typically find someone in that scenario saying, well, I could tolerate a couple more hours without urinating. So what about that challenge to your analogy?
To be fair, it's probably not reasonable to expect you to wait hours if you already have to use the restroom. Same thing with lactation, though. I mean, her breasts were going to begin leaking at any minute. So I think it is still an apt comparison. And
I'm just concerned that she didn't testify that way.
She testified that, you know, it wasn't intolerable to the extent that she could maybe endure the physical pain a little bit longer. Later on in her deposition, though, she clarified that it certainly was intolerable to her that her employer was causing her physical pain. She testified it was certainly intolerable to her that her employer wasn't giving her a place to express milk. So with that respect, I mean, she did testify that it was intolerable to her that day. The test to be
With respect to the adverse employment action, are you relying solely on constructive discharge?
Also actual discharge, Your Honor.
And was that argued to the district court?
It was argued to the district court in the sense that we directed the district court's attention to facts that would indicate an actual discharge. And that's what the Second Circuit said was necessary in the Churchkova case that we cite in our brief. They said if the plaintiff has drawn the district court's attention to facts that would indicate actual discharge, it doesn't matter that they didn't directly argue it. And we would assert that that is what we did in this case.
If we considered that to be a waiver of that question, and if we didn't agree with that you rose to the level of constructive discharge, would that be sufficient to decide the case against you?
I think you're correct, Your Honor. I think we either have to win either actual or constructive discharge.
Okay.
With respect to the constructive discharge claim, the test is an objective one. The district court was required to consider the evidence from the perspective of a reasonable person in the employee's position. The last part of that phrase means something, and it can't just be ignored. A reasonable person is not just some hypothetical person in a bubble who's not experiencing any of the same physical or mental circumstances of the plaintiff. For instance, in Young versus Southwest Savings and Loan, the Fifth Circuit case that we cite in our brief, they concluded that an atheist who quit in response to being forced to attend religious meetings had a claim for constructive discharge. The court didn't ask how a reasonable, generic person would respond to forced religious meetings. They asked how an atheist would respond to forced religious meetings. Let's look at it another way. In the context of a sexual harassment case where the victim ultimately quits, you ask whether that was reasonable given the nature and severity of the harassment she suffered, not whether it would be reasonable for someone who had never been harassed to quit. In this case, at a bare minimum, a reasonable person in Angela Ames' position on that day must be a woman who is lactating and is in intense physical pain because her breasts are engorged and is 8 weeks postpartum. Taking these factors into account does not suddenly make the standard subjective. It simply allows for all factors that may weigh on the intolerableness of a situation to be considered by the fact finder. These were not subjective experiences that Angela was experiencing only because she was weak or sensitive. It's a biological fact that anyone in Angela's position would have been experiencing these same things. The district court erred in failing to consider these factors in its constructive discharge analysis. I think it also bears noting that an employee's work environment does not need to be literally unbearable in order to prove constructive discharge. The Van Meter case, the Iowa Supreme Court case we cite in our brief, held that. This court has repeatedly held that if an employee quits because she reasonably believes that she has no chance for fair treatment in the organization, then constructive discharge has occurred. That was the holding in the Kinsey case and also the Sanders case that's cited in our materials. And I think this is certainly a way that Angela Ames, in this case, can prove constructive discharge. A reasonable jury could certainly find that it was reasonable for her to believe that even if she stayed at Nationwide, she was not going to be treated fairly. Not only was that evidenced by her treatment from Ms. Neal and Mr. Brinks prior to her leave, but in the first 3 hours she was back to work, they caused her physical pain and denied her a place to express milk in violation of federal law. So we would argue, Your Honors, that we have proven constructive discharge under that standard as well. Briefly to address our direct evidence argument, Neal's comment to Angela that she should just go home and be with her babies is direct evidence of discrimination and is by itself enough to get Angela past summary judgment. This comment reeks of stereotypical ideas regarding the ability of mothers to be productive and valuable employees. This comment was made by the head of Angela's department at the exact time she was handing her a piece of paper and telling her what words to write down in order to resign. We would urge the court to look to the Sheehan case that we cite in our brief and disregard the Piantanita case for the reasons that we set forth in our brief. And I see that my yellow light is on, and I would like to reserve
one,
my
one
final
One quick question. Who first suggested resignation?
Ms. Neal.
Mr. Harrington, good morning. You're here for the EEOC?
I am.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eric Harrington. I'm here on behalf of the EEOC. I'd like to start with Judge Grunder's question about actual discharge and waiver. It's our position that thinking of this question as a waiver is really not the right way to think about it. And in Schneider versus Jack Shack, this court said that in a case where a plaintiff only raised constructive discharge, that the district court should have focused first on the antecedent
question.
Yeah,
but that case doesn't say whether the issue was argued to the district court.
I think any fair reading of the lower court opinion in that case, there's no suggestion that actual discharge was argued. And in fact, I think that this court's opinion explicitly took down this question, and it said the doctrine of constructive discharge is addressed to the situation where the employee quits because of intolerable working conditions, and the doctrine thus, by definition, this court said, assumes the absence of an explicit discharge. Or, as this court also said in that opinion, the district court should address the antecedent question of actual discharge. And I think there's very good reasons for that, for this court's reasons, not just the plaintiff's reasons. If this court were to analyze this case under constructive discharge, I think all the briefs demonstrate this well, there seems to be a whole bunch of different doctrines floating around in constructive discharge law. One is the intolerable standard that has developed primarily as a means to figure out when there's been an adverse employment action necessary to give rise to liability under the Farragher-Ellick regime. We think that that constructive discharge doctrine is really a difficult fit with disparate treatment claims like this. And this court implicitly recognized this just last year in the Sanders decision, where it concluded that a demotion was sufficient to give rise to a constructive discharge. The Seventh Circuit has made this rule explicit outside the context of harassment. All this is to say that I think that there's difficult constructive discharge questions, and this court would not have to address it at all if it analyzed it what I think is a quite easy actual discharge case, given the evidence in the record.
Why is it an easy actual discharge case?
Yeah, I think if an employer says to you, I think it's best that you go home to your babies.
I thought the employer said maybe you should go home and take care of your babies.
I think there are two statements in the record, and I think drawing all facts and inferences in favor of the plaintiff, you take the strongest one. So, consider the second one.
Well, I just thought that the plaintiff agreed that the statement was maybe in the response to the motion for summary judgment. So even if there's something else in the record, I thought maybe she'd be bound by that. But if you don't think so, then...
But I will take on the maybe line. I think it does as much work. Maybe I think it's best that you go home to your babies, or maybe you should go home to your babies. Ms. Ames is stunned. She says nothing. And Ms. Neal gets out a pad and hands it to her, and then Ms. Ames says, I don't know what to do, and she says, just right. I think if you were to call in a law clerk and say, I think it's best, maybe you should go home, and they're saying they're stunned, and you get out a pad and say, I hereby resign, everyone will recognize, or at the very least, a reasonable juror can conclude that your employment is being terminated. I think it's also telling that in Ms. Ames's charge of discrimination with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, she checked the box forced to quit. So it's, you know, and I think these kind of actual discharge do not require the magic words you're fired, because as we can all recognize, there are all sorts of employment situations where we're being terminated, and you may use less than direct language to accomplish that. But I think drawing all facts and inferences in favor of Ms. Ames, a juror could conclude that a reasonable person would believe that her employment is being terminated. If there are no further questions, I want to move to the really quickly on the big issue in this case, and that is the district court's rejection of all evidence of direct sex discrimination here. As the plaintiff has already argued, I think the district court erred in discounting the evidence of gender stereotypes that were evinced by Ms. Neal. The district court relied on this court's decision in Piantanita. We think Piantanita is distinguishable because in that case, this court was only construing the PDA, a specific clause in the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. And we think this court should at the very least distinguish that case, because if this court were to reaffirm Piantanita on sex discrimination grounds, this court would stand alone in conflict with the Seventh, the Second, and the First Circuit. And we also think the Supreme Court and the Hibbs decision. I think in that decision, the Supreme Court made clear that this kind of gender-based stereotype, that a woman's role is in the home and as a caregiver, is so central, and it's such a central problem in sex discrimination law, that it warranted giving a right to men and to abrogate state sovereign immunity. So quite plainly, the Supreme Court thinks this is the kind of sex discrimination that lies at the core of, in that case, the 14th Amendment's protections. Unless the court has any questions...
What's your best case, precedent-wise, that this was an actual discharge? Do you have anything factually in the ballpark?
Oh, I think there are cases that are less, meaning...
All right, well, give me one that's
the facts
less.
That are less so. I think this court's decision in Schneider, where it was just a demotion, or she was moved from a bartender to a cocktail waitress.
Well, but there was affirmative action by the employer to demote her.
And then this court's in Sanders, again, another... I think if you can say just being demoted where you're clearly still employed, that's an actual discharge where I think it's best that you go home, or maybe you should go home, and here's how you go home and write out a resignation, would evince evidence of being terminated. And then also, the last one I'll point you to is the Fourth Circuit case, EEOC versus Service News. That's the case where she was a pregnancy case where she was told...
But there's a lot more detail there about unemployment benefits and so forth, right? Is that the one?
Yeah, but again, I think this case is stronger because the message is so clear. Maybe you should go home, stunned, here's a pad, write I hereby resign. I don't think I would be confused if my employer told me that.
Very well.
I think you're...
Ms. James, good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case actually is a simple constructive discharge case under the well-established law of both Iowa and the circuit. And although we as lawyers and students of the law typically like to start at the beginning and proceed logically through our analysis, we deal with jurisdiction and threshold issues. This is really a case where if you skip to the end, it is very clear that Ms. Ames did not give her an employer a chance to fix her concerns. And this case can be affirmed on that ground without a whole lot of effort or analysis. She admits that she never went back to the wellness room that the nurse had showed her, showed her to on the morning she came back to work and told her it would probably be available in 10 or 15 minutes. She never went back to that room. She never made any complaints about the things that she is urging now as some kind of pregnancy or gender animus. She never complained to anyone within Nationwide about the comments before she went out on leave. She never complained to anyone that she had been forced to return back to work on pain of discipline or firing. She never complained that the lactation policy was unfair, and she never made any complaint about the baby.
What is she supposed to say in the response? Why don't you go home with your babies? Is she supposed to argue with people?
Well, she certainly could have gone home and called HR and said, hey, I was forced to quit and I didn't want to. Nationwide had all
are
these...
Is Nationwide entitled to that type of notice? I mean, they know the law better than we do. I mean, you don't make comments like that. Why shouldn't they be held to an almost absolute standard of liability?
Well, this court's never held that merely suggesting that employee might want to resign if she's
not happy.
Maybe
the time has come for that. We have to rid ourselves of these stereotypes.
Well, Your Honor, the Allen versus Bridgestone Firestone tire case that we cite in our briefs, it was not a pregnancy case, but it was a case where an employee who'd been complaining about harassment asked to transfer, and the transfer was denied, and his manager said, well, if you don't like it, you can quit, or you can take some job as a floater. Merely suggesting that resignation is an option is not firing.
Well, haven't we moved beyond those dim, dark years where you're required what you would require to an employee to do?
Well, in terms of, you know, if the court...
Maybe this will be a good learning experience for your client.
If the court interprets Ms. Ames' testimony about Ms. Neal's comment, maybe you should go home to your babies, maybe you should stay home with your babies, as showing discriminatory animus, that still is not enough to meet the constructive discharge standard that is well established in the...
What about actual discharge? Your colleague from the EEOC says it's an easy case under actual discharge because she suggested resignation and gave her a piece of paper and told her to write out resignation. What do you say to that?
Well, I do take issue with, I do not believe it is clear in the record who first suggested leaving her employment as an option.
Taking the facts in the light most favorable to Ames.
Ms. Ames does not testify that. And in fact, if you look at her complaint to the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, She says nothing about Ms. Neal. It doesn't mention the baby's argument. What she says in that complaint, which is actually in our addendum, and it the
what about in her deposition, though, in this case?
Or in affidavits. We're not limited to the Iowa civil rights complaint.
True, but she doesn't. I mean, even in her testimony in this case, she said she went to Ms. Neal. She was desperate. She had already decided after her meeting with Mr. Brinks that there was no way she could meet the performance obligations expected of her, because she had to keep up with her work. She was going to have to take this extra time to express breast milk, and she was overwhelmed with the prospect of meeting her job responsibilities when she went for the second time to Ms. Neal asking for help getting around the corporate red tape to get to a lactation room, when she knew and she admitted that it was not Ms. Neal's job in the corporate organization to provide her with that.
What, remind me again, or refresh me, what is the time sequence here from the day she came back to work until the day she quit?
3 hours, Your Honor.
3 hours.
3 hours. And by her own testimony, she never consulted the policies available to her on the intranet and the corporate intranet to make arrangements to see if she had to make any.
One would think in this day and age that they would have had some. Is it that big a deal to for a company to have to provide this lactation room?
Actually, no. And Nationwide has a very good method of doing that.
Well, why wasn't that available that day?
Because they wanted the nursing mothers in their workforce to have immediate access without going to a nurse, without going to a security guard.
So how are they supposed to give the 3 days notice if they're not back to work yet?
Well, the company has these maternity meetings every quarter so that if you're pregnant, you can attend one of them. Or you can go on the internet and check the policy. And they all have badges that open various doors around the facility. And so what they do is they allow the people who need access to the lactation rooms for their badges and their badges only to open the doors to those rooms. And that takes a little bit of time.
But they don't have a process whereby a new mother on the first day back to work can come in first thing in the morning and get the badge.
Well,
she's got to come back and wait 3 days, it sounds like.
She can apply for the access before she goes out on maternity leave. There's no time. That's why they have these meetings.
And did Ms. Ames explain why she hadn't done that or didn't do that?
No, she does not answer that question. She just says she didn't have time to read the policy. She
said she didn't know about the three-day rule, right?
Right. That's her testimony. She found out about it on her first day back. And the nurse did the best she could for her by showing her to another room that she could use in the meantime. And she sent an email to corporate security saying, expedite her badge access.
I thought that same nurse discouraged her from using it because of the possibility of germ contamination.
There was no discouragement from using the room for the purposes of relieving the discomfort. What the nurse advised her was not to feed the milk to the baby because it could be exposed to infection. But the nurse didn't say, no, wait 6 hours or 8 hours before you pump. No, here's a room you can use in 15 or 20 minutes. I urge the court to look at the Trierweiler case, which this court decided in 2011. It is a constructive discharge case. And the court does some analysis of the intolerability standard, but really jumps to the end, like I'm suggesting you should do here. In the Trierweiler case, this was a pregnancy case. The woman worked at a bank. She had a lot of attendance issues unrelated to her pregnancy, but was out on her very first few days of pregnancy-related leave, not for the birth, but for some issues that had occurred before the birth. And her boss had a lot of problems with her attendance, and so the claim was the boss said, miss one more day and you're done. And then while she was out on that week of pregnancy-related leave, her testimony was that her boss called her and said, this isn't going to work, you being out. And she testified that she believed she was fired based on that comment. The court held in that case she did not give her employer, the bank, a reasonable opportunity to fix the problem.
If this case went to the jury on constructive discharge, how would the jury be instructed as to the standard by which this woman should be judged? The reasonable person. the reasonable lactating mother, in effect?
Your Honor, we've never contended that it should be a reasonable man standard or a reasonable person not lactating standard.
But there might be a few women on that jury who had been through that same experience and would have a decidedly unsympathetic view of what your client did.
Your Honor, the person in Ms. Ames' shoes gets to work and finds out that she was supposed to have made advance arrangements and she didn't, but a nurse is trying to help her.
Let's see, how old was the child at the time?
About 8 weeks.
Okay.
8 weeks.
So it was not immediately after the childbirth. What about this telephone conversation?
Well, Your Honor...
Is that part of the record?
Indeed it is, and in fact, we think that it's so important not to be swayed by the rhetoric that the plaintiff uses in her briefs about what happened on that call. That call was recorded. Nationwide has a lot of has a telephone recording.
You gave us a copy of it.
And I listened to it.
At one point, for a while, it sounds like Ms. Neal is very helpful and positive. And at one point, your client obviously was under a lot of emotion. She starts crying. Ms. Neal being disingenuous about being so helpful? Maybe it turned out later that she was not nearly as helpful as she had been on the telephone call.
Well, there's nothing in that telephone call that would permit a reasonable inference that she was acting on, Ms. Neal was acting on any kind of discriminatory animus. She was sharing her own experiences as a working mother.
At the time, you're right. She seemed to be very sympathetic, but later she was not quite so sympathetic.
Well, Your Honor, we do not have a recording of that conversation. What we have is admissions by Ms. Ames that she knew Ms. Neal was not the person she was supposed to be dealing with in the corporate organization in terms of any issues having to do with babies. She went to Ms. Neal saying, I need a place to express breast milk. Ms. Neal said, it's not my job. Ms. Ames regards that as...
Typical bureaucratic response. One would think, it's not my job, but I'll see what I can do to help you.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, Ms. Neal was doing exactly what Nationwide wanted her to do. That's why Nationwide has occupational nurses. The court is well aware of all of the issues created in the workforce when an operational manager has knowledge about the medical, the private, personal issues involving employees. So a big company like Nationwide that has the ability to have company nurses on staff to address those issues and take line operational management out of the mix of even dealing with those issues actually avoids a lot of problems. And there's a similarity here from the hostile environment area, the cases where an employer sets up the policy about what you do to call attention to something you believe is inappropriate, offensive conduct in the workplace. And this court has gone along with the majority in saying you've got to do what the employer says. You've got to complain to the person the employer sends you to complain to, as long as it's not the person who you claim is harassing you. And it was just similar. When
was actual discharge fairly presented to the district court? And if not, are we required to consider it under Schneider versus Jack Shack?
No, it was never presented to the district court. The issue of actual discharge was raised for the very first time in the briefs to this court. You can look at the...
All right, so does Schneider versus Jack Shack require us to consider it anyway?
Your Honor, no, it does not. That case has never been cited again by this court. It's only been cited 7 times. 3 of those decisions are unpublished. And
I shouldn't laugh, but...
Who wrote that opinion, anyway?
And it's never been cited for the...
Well, maybe the issue never came up again, though. I mean... it's never been cited, but...
For a rule that you have to consider actual discharge if it was not raised below. There is a huge wealth of authority in this circuit and other circuits that this court's not going to consider arguments that are raised for the first time.
Well, do you have any case that says that in an actual discharge
situation?
Context, I have not come across in that context.
Well,
but.
Then I don't know where it gets you to say Schneider's never been cited if the issue's never come up or been decided the other way.
Well, and Schneider was not a summary judgment case. Schneider was a bench trial. And basically the appellate court was looking at the findings of fact that the district court had made and basically said, well, here, you found actual discharge, so why are you applying the constructive discharge standard? That is a much different context than a summary judgment motion when all of a sudden, when the case gets up on appeal, the plaintiff starts arguing actual discharge. It also was not exhausted. I mean, we have the whole body of case law and the requirement that an employer be given a chance to conciliate. And so she never believed she was discharged. She never asserted to the Iowa Civil Rights Commission that she was discharged. The EEOC counsel referred to her complaint form and that she checked forced to quit. Well, yes, that's constructive discharge, and that's what she claimed from the beginning. She did not check the box that said terminated.
What went wrong here? Why would a person with her employment, how long had she worked for the company?
I believe about 2 years. Don't hold me to that fact, Your Honor.
And she seemed to have a good relationship, at least during the phone call with Ms. Neal. What triggered her decision within 3 hours to do what she did?
She assumed the worst. And that is exactly what this court says parties cannot do in constructive discharge cases. They cannot jump to the conclusion that it's not going to work and end the employment relationship before giving their employer time to work out the problem. I know my red light is on, so I
probably a good time to sit down. Yes, very well.
Thank you.
Ms. McCarty, you may proceed.
Your Honors, defendants never told Angela to review their lactation policy or that it even existed. When she specifically asked where she would pump when she returned from maternity leave, case manager Samfong Bakam told her it would be in a lactation room. That was it. No one told her she needed to do anything else. A reasonable jury could certainly believe that Angela justifiably believed that she could just show up for work that day with her breast pump and be just fine. To direct you to the record, that's in Bakam's deposition at page 441 of the appendix and Ames' deposition in page 507 of the
appendix. There any duty on her part to take advantage of the procedures that the court, that the company had, the periodic review of what they did for lactating mothers?
May I go ahead and answer?
Of course you may.
The break time for nursing mothers law that required her to be given this room when she went to work that day doesn't contain any kind of exception that says that if an employer has a policy that says it can violate this law, it can go ahead and violate this law. So for that respect, Your Honor, you know, she had a legal right to expect a room that day, regardless of whether she went to a maternity meeting or not. Second, I think a reasonable jury could look at this and infer that, you know, why didn't any of her supervisors who knew about these meetings and knew about the policy and procedure for getting a room encourage her to do that or bring it to her attention in any meaningful way? I think that's
at what point should they have done this?
Pardon, Your Honor?
At what point should they have done these things for her?
I think at any time would have been appropriate when she was...
During the three-hour period that she was making her decision to leave? Or?
I think any assistance, any meaningful assistance anyone could have given her in that 3 hours would have been very helpful.
And then finally, what is your response to Ms. James' response to my question that she assumed the worst?
Your Honor, I think it's a misstatement of the record. Angela needed a place to express milk at the time she needed it on, you know, July 19th. It's unreasonable to suggest that she could wait days or even weeks for some corporate bureaucracy to work. She went to Ms. Neal, the person most accessible to her that had the power to fix this. Ms. Neal could have done any number of things. She could have said, pump in my office. Let me call someone and see if you can pump in a vacant office. Or, you know, whoa, rough first day back to work. Why don't we all just take a break, come back tomorrow, we'll get this sorted out. But she didn't do any of those things. And I think the jury's entitled to look at this and say, why not? Because it's evidence of gender discrimination and pregnancy discrimination.
Very well. Thank you, all counsel, for the arguments. The case is submitted. We will take it under consideration.